Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Please do take your seats. Thank you all so much for joining us again this morning. Many of you were at our board meeting earlier today. Can everybody hear me? Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you all for many of you for joining us at our board meeting this morning, and certainly for throughout our meeting yesterday. Yesterday was a fabulous day celebrating the past 25 years and indeed the past 300 or so years of Jewish merchants and Jewish history in South Carolina. And I'm so excited this morning to be looking towards the future, to be thinking about what the next 25, the next 50, perhaps beyond for Jewish South Carolina and the Jewish future look like in our state and beyond. It really is my pleasure in doing so to welcome and to introduce in just a second our first guest of the morning, Rabbi Judy Schindler, and after her, Steve Weissman, who's also joined us this morning from D.C. It really is a great pleasure to introduce Rabbi Schindler because she's become a friend not only of the Jewish Historical Society, but also of the Jewish Studies program at the college. She's spoken from this podium a number of times. Steve Whitfield gave me a hard time from inviting him back last night, but that's certainly been true of Rabbi Schindler as well. And the lesson there is that when you know a good thing, bring them back, continue to learn from them. Both Steve and certainly Rabbi Schindler are fantastic teachers, and I continue to enjoy learning from her. I think that y'all will this morning as well. Rabbi Judy Schindler is the Sklut Professor of Jewish Studies and Director of the Stan Greenspan Center for Peace and Social Justice at Queens University of Charlotte. She was named Rabbi Emerita of Temple Beth El in Charlotte, North Carolina, after serving as Senior Rabbi from 2013 to 2016 and as Associate Rabbi from 1998 till 2003. She's contributed chapters and articles to more than 10 books. She co-authored Recharging Judaism, How Civic Engagement is Good for Synagogues, Jews, and America, which was published in 2018 and was a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award in Contemporary Jewish Life and Practice. Among the many awards she's received, Rabbi Schindler was named Charlotte Woman of the Year in 2011. It is my pleasure and hope that you will join me in welcoming Rabbi Judy Schindler.
Yes.
All right, you can hear me? Is it okay? Okay. So it is great to be here. I love Charleston. I love College of Charleston, and most of all, I love Jewish Studies at College of Charleston, and this is my first time presenting to the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina, but you will soon be on my list of favorites as I make my way down to Charleston. My memories go back a long time ago when my father was here. Oh gosh, it was like 1997, he dedicated the Holocaust Memorial. We had a surprise event for my mom, and my husband and I were just engaged and joined the family down here. So I have lots of great memories from Charleston, so it's an honor to be here. I was asked to talk about the future and envision the future, and I just found a quote from Yogi Berra, and I lost that quote, but it was so good. He said, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. So I knew he would have some wisdom, and I found that wisdom. It is so great to be here. I'll do my best to talk about the future. I'm just so honored to cherish the past with all of you and celebrate and be part of your 25th anniversary. What a rich and critical history you all have to capture. You have so much to celebrate, and we have so much to celebrate as a Jewish community of the Carolinas. And Dale Rosengarten was given the Order of the Jewish Palmetto last night, well deserved. When I was at the archives, the American Jewish Archives, this past week, studying and doing research, and I mentioned that I was going to be down here, and they said about her, those who run the archives in Cincinnati, they said she single-handedly created your archives. She is a one-woman powerhouse. And of course, where is Mark? Marty. It's an honor to be here. I don't know where he is, but he is an inspiration. As I left the congregational pulpit to move to Queen's University, he has been my guiding inspiration. What he's built at College of Charleston inspires awe. And so I look to all of you as a model for what I aspire to create. Even if I could create one-tenth of what you created, I would be very fulfilled and satisfied. And of course, Mark Swick is amazing. He's committed to supporting Jewish communities across the South, and he's impressive. He shares his vision and wisdom and warmth of hospitality. And to all of you, how impressive that you're so committed to sustaining our Jewish history, really embracing it and celebrating it. How humbled I am to be part of this panel of scholars. I am a developing academic. In Hebrew letters, and so I'm humbled to be a part of this panel, this collection of scholars. What I love most about studying Jewish history is that the problems that we're dealing with today have been dealt with before, and each time I go and delve into archives and learn from great rabbis and great leaders and great teachers, that wisdom speaks to me today and in the future as we confront our problems. We have confronted these problems in the past, the problems we're facing today, and we need to really listen to the lessons and the wisdom of the past as we respond in the future. Ecclesiastes taught, Ma shehaya, hu sheyehyeh, that which has been, which shall be again, that which has been done, will be done again. Ein kol chadash tachat hashemesh, there is nothing new under the sun, Ecclesiastes taught. And so, as we look at our future of American Judaism, we really need to also look and celebrate our past. So this talk, we will define civic engagement as it is so critical to our future. What is it? We'll look at the past, these key quick moments of the past that really guide our future. We'll look at the present, the who, what, and why of civic engagement right now. Why are we doing it? Why is it relevant? And then the future, why is it imperative that we continue along the path of those great Jews from generations past and we embrace it and be out there in the community? And we'll look at Jewish identity, Jewish survival, Israel, and confronting anti-Semitism. Jewish civic engagement, the past, the present, and the future. So first we need to define civic engagement. There are two definitions I offer today. One is the one we use at universities when we think about a great university. We are trying to teach our students how to make a difference in the civic life of their students. We're trying to give them the combination of knowledge, skills, and values and motivation to make that difference. So imagine if we put that in our religious schools. Why do you need to be engaged in your communities? Why does it matter? And we're going to give you those skills. And it is a means of promoting the quality of life in the community through political and non-political processes. In our book, Judy Selden Cohen and I, our book published, I have to say this, by contract, by CCAR Press in 2018, in our book we talk about what is this civic engagement thing. It's a way of improving our collective future. To think about all those who live in our community, whether it's issues of policing or immigration or healthcare, how do we work in such a way that we increase and improve all of our futures? It's nonpartisan, but it may involve political processes to change a local, state, or federal system, right? So if something's not working, we think, okay, how can we create a change in that system? What's an achievable goal we think of as our center at Queen's University? What's something we can achieve within a year? And we work and we meet with all city councilmen or all county commissioners or state legislators in order to move that forward. And it may entail mobilizing consumers or other stakeholders to use their power, right? We can boycott or we can pressure companies to change unsustainable or unethical practices. We have a parable we use when we think about civic engagement. There's the story of a river, a little village and a river, and somebody was drowning in the river. Someone jumped in the river to pull that person to safety and was hailed as a hero. Several days later, again, someone was drowning in the river and someone jumped in and saved that person. So what did the village do? They put a lot of money into lifeguards so that every time someone fell into the waters, they could pull that person out to safety. And then someone said, why don't we move upstream and see why people are falling into the river in the first place? social service is helping those who are in desperate and hard times. Social justice is moving upstream to eradicate the root causes. So social service addresses symptoms, right? We try to alleviate the suffering, and going upstream addresses the core sources. So how do we do both at the same time? Deuteronomy 15 says, there shall be no needy among you, right? That's the vision. If we all gave charity, if we all gave what people needed to have their basics, there would be no needy among us. If people had food and shelter and basics of health care. But really, that's not the ideal. The real is, there will never cease to be needy among you, which is at the end of Deuteronomy 15. The real is, we need both, right? We need to pull people out of the rivers of hard times, and we need to go upstream to address root causes. So now we're going to look at some key moments of the past. It's impossible to deal with Jewish social justice, Jewish civic engagement in the future without looking at the past. What are the values? What's the history that guides us? We have Zelophehad's daughters in Numbers. They weren't going to inherit. These five daughters, their father died. They weren't going to inherit any land. What did they do? They gathered together. In Hebrew, Bati Kravna, Benot Zelophehad, and they drew near to the leadership. They went to the tent of meeting. They called out the leaders and they said, this is not right, in a kind way. They didn't rebel dramatically, right? They didn't rebel. I often don't rebel outside of a bank, right? I call it advocacy and pearls. We know a lot of people. We can make a difference, right? At dinner parties, at cocktail parties, to say, you know, this practice doesn't seem right, or is there something we can do to change our practice. So the daughters of Zelophehad, they approached Moses and the leadership, and they spoke in language they could understand, right? They said, you know, our father died. It's not right, because he had no sons, that his name should be lost. His name will be lost, so let us inherit land. And Moses brought the case to God, and God said their case is right. And so they were able to inherit land. They changed the history of the future based on their ability to stand up and to ask and to petition. As Jews, we love to complain. The book of Numbers, we complained for 38 years through the wilderness. Some call that book Sefer HaKvetch, the book of kvetching. But in the midst of kvetching, right, we actually organize and we create change. So we can kvetch or we can organize to create the change that we believe needs to happen. There are other really powerful examples of social justice. Kedoshim. Kedoshim for Reform synagogues, this Torah portion called Kedoshim is at the heart of Leviticus. Now Leviticus is all about sacrifice, but in the middle is this portion that tells us how to bring holiness into the world. David Einhorn, a rabbi who spoke passionately against slavery, he was run out of Baltimore because of it, almost lost his life because of it. He was chased out of Baltimore. He envisioned, he created a prayer book in the late 19th century called Olat Tamid, the ever-burning sacrifice, and or the continually burning sacrifice. And he said, we need to put Kedoshim on Yom Kippur afternoon, this valuable portion. In conservative and Orthodox synagogues, they read about other portions like sexual indiscretions and the sacrifice offering for Yom Kippur, but we read this portion called Kedoshim. What's important about Kedoshim is it says that we should leave the corners of our fields for the needy, right? Which is really about economic justice. We should not place a stumbling block before the blind. That's disability rights. We should care for the immigrant. As we strive for immigrant justice, we should practice ethical business practices. Did I actually miss one? Oh, no, I'm good. Okay. So Kedoshim talks about all these values at the heart of our service of what type of society we should create. Isaiah, when we're starving on Yom Kippur afternoon, Isaiah calls out, we read from the text, is this the fast I desire? To bow your heads and lie in sackcloth and ashes? No, this is the fast I desire, to unlock the fetters of wickedness, to untie the cords of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, to share your bread with the hungry, to take the wretched poor into your home. Amos talks about do not offer prayers if you're not acting ethically in your world. God says, I despise your religious festivals. Away with the noise of your songs and the music of your harps. Let justice roll down like a river. righteousness like a never-failing stream. And then Jeremiah, really important, Jeremiah foresaw a time when we'd be out of our land, and we're going to be exiled. We're going to be all over the world at some point. And he says, seek the peace of the city in which you live. Seek the shalom, the wholeness, the justice in the city in which you live. For in its peace, you shall find peace. So we were called right before our diaspora to be engaged in the cities in which we lived. Now, for many centuries, we could not do that. For many millennia, we were ghettoized. We didn't have that ability, a full citizenship. But as soon as we did, as soon as those ghetto walls broke down, as you can see in South Carolina, as soon as we got to America and had that freedom, we always strived to make a difference. I am missing, I believe, Nathan to King David. We don't have time to go into the story, but does anybody know what King David did that was really bad? Had an affair with Bathsheba. She got pregnant. He was in big trouble. He had her husband killed at war. So pretty racy stuff. Would make a very good movie. He slept with her while Bathsheba's husband was off at war. He brought Uriah back home. He wouldn't sleep with his wife. That was a problem. King David tried to get Uriah drunk to see if he'd sleep with his wife. Didn't work. Sent him back. Got him killed. Nathan, the prophet, has to speak truth to power. How do you speak truth to King David? He said there's a parable. There's a parable of a rich man who has many sheep and cattle and everything, and there's a poor man who has one little ewe lamb, and he sleeps with the lamb, and the lamb eats at his table. And a foreigner comes in, and the rich man doesn't share any of his food with this traveler and takes the little ewe of the poor man and kills it and serves it to the guest. And King David said, that's outrageous. That man should be put to death. And Nathan says, that man is you. So the work of civic engagement is speaking truth to power. So it's organizing like the Daughters of Tzalafkat. It's building power. It's addressing issues. It's creating systemic change. It's creating justice for everyone in our communities and being engaged. And it is also speaking truth to power. If you move forward, fast forward many years, many centuries, to the Revolutionary War, this document is so powerful. In Torah Synagogue in Rhode Island, Providence, Rhode Island, there was a president of a synagogue. And he, George Washington was traveling the country after he became president in 1789. And so the president wasn't called president of a synagogue, he was called a warden, which is actually a better title for a president of a synagogue, right, than president. So the warden of the synagogue, Moses Seixas, he actually wrote a letter to George Washington. This is what advocacy means. Advocacy means when you speak, when I speak to the mayor, and then I hear her using my words in public, I'm like, yes, good job, right? When we speak to officials, anytime we meet with them, we're getting into their heads, right? And that's going to impact what they do. So here's the most monumental thing. This president of the synagogue, he wrote George Washington, as did the Savannah Synagogue and many others. Savannah has, and Charleston too. We always have gotten engaged and congratulated presidents and used our power. But what's so monumental about this letter from Seixas is that he says to him, he's writing on behalf of the children of Abraham, and he says, you know, deprived as we have been as individuals hitherto of individual rights as free citizens, we now behold a government which to bigotry gives no sanction, to persecution no assistance, both generously affording all liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship, deeming everyone of whatever nation, tongue, or language equal parts of the great governmental machine. So Seixas, the president, writes a letter to George Washington, and George Washington writes a letter back. And in that letter, he makes a commitment, using Seixas' words, to bigotry, this country will be a country which to bigotry gives no sanction, and to persecution, no assistance. That is the power of civic engagement, and that is what we need to do today. People say, it's not a Jewish thing, it's not a congregational thing, we shouldn't be doing it, we have to worry about Jews, we have to worry about insights. No, we need to be doing it, because if we're not doing it, we are in danger as a community, and we need to be building bridges with others, because if we don't, we are going to be marginalized and isolated and ghettoized, and nobody's going to be worrying about us. So today, there's in Charlotte Observer an editorial published with me and an imam talking about white nationalism. Now, this imam and I disagree on Palestinian issues. He said things that I really don't like, but I took the risk and said, let's write this editorial together. And through Ramadan, he's like working on the editorial at 3 a.m., and you know, we're going back and forth. We wrote, I think, a really nice piece together. So we have to be out there. We have to be out there on boards. We have to be out there engaged. We have to be at meetings. We cannot just be inside our walls, or we are in very deep trouble as a community, and Israel is in very deep trouble if you care about Israel. This is another great example of our strong relationship with President Lincoln. President Lincoln had Jews who were friends. President Lincoln, we're going to see another letter where he appointed a Jew as a captain. This letter, well, I don't, actually, for some reason, this is an older one, but I have a letter where he appointed a Jew as captain of the army. He said, I believe we have not yet appointed a Jew as captain, Lincoln wrote in his note to Secretary of War, urging him to appoint an Orthodox Jew, Shem Moise Levy, born to a notable New York rabbinic family, the rank of captain. Lincoln also appointed 50 Jews to be quartermasters, overseeing housing, supplies, transportation, and clothing for the troops. Well, does anybody know about General Order Grant's order number 11? Right? This was the most egregious example of the anti-Semitism in the history of North American Jewry. In December of 1862, he issued this statement expelling Jews from his department in Tennessee, Kentucky, and segments of Mississippi and Alabama. Thankfully, the single time in history that Jews were banished from the region was short-lived. Advocates quickly appealed to Lincoln, whom they came to lovingly refer to as Father Abraham, and the order was soon revoked. Lincoln also made sure that Jews could be chaplains in the army for the first time. He enabled Jews to be chaplain in the army. What else do we have? Yeah, Lincoln threw his support behind Jewish chaplains and approved the first Jewish military chaplain on September 8th, 1862, Reverend Jacob Frankel of Rhode Shalom in Philadelphia. And lastly, there was an effort to try to Christianize the Constitution, and Jews use their relationship with Lincoln to stop that in its path. And then, of course, we have Nostra Aetate. Does anybody know what that is? 1965. There was a rabbi named Rabbi Tannenbaum. He worked, a graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary, and he became friends with Heschel. Heschel was his professor, and Heschel saw him despairing, this Rabbi Tannenbaum, in an elevator one day. Tannenbaum's father just had a heart attack. Heschel invited him into his office for 2 hours, talked to him, called his mother. After Tannenbaum left seminary, he worked for a publisher and got Heschel's first book published. Hmm. And then he started to create conferences. He created a conference in Washington on religion and race, a conference on different conferences, saw Heschel's power. Then Tannenbaum created the Conference on Religion and Race in Chicago. Heschel opened the conference, Martin Luther King closed the conference, they became fast friends. Heschel and King, they didn't meet before that conference, they used the same text. The Amos 5, let justice roll down like waters, my righteousness like a mighty string, and they both used the Exodus narrative, and we'll see what happened with that friendship. But as this guy, Rabbi Tannenbaum, was at lunch planning these conferences, he befriended a bishop. And this bishop kept asking him to lunch. And he realized there's a great power out there. There are all these Christians at the table, and we're not at the table, and there's a great place for us. Ultimately, he became very involved in Christian relations. He was the only rabbinic observer to Nostra Aetate, which was the statement by Vatican II, which said Jews are no longer collectively responsible for the death of Jesus. It took till 1965 for us to get the statement from the Pope that has caused historic persecution. How was that created? By being out there in the world and by building relationships. So we need to know our stuff, we need to study, we need to build relationships, we need to be out there, because that's going to change our fate for our future. Being out there and continuing to ensure policies support us and are sensitive to our needs. And then we had Abraham Joshua Heschel go down south to Selma with Dr. Martin Luther King, a monumental moment. He left the seminary in March, and you probably know this, but he said, what was the experience like? He said, I felt my legs were praying. I was praying with my feet, is the way most people see it. So when you're out there in the community, you're taking your prayers into the world, you are praying with your feet. And then this is an anti-Vietnam rally. This is Dr. Eisendrath, Maurice Eisendrath, the president of the Reform Movement, with a Torah, Martin Luther King, Abraham Joshua Heschel. We need to live our faith not only inside our sanctuaries, but we need to live our faith outside the sanctuary. So those are excerpts from the past that I think need to guide our future. So let us now talk about the present. Okay, the present. Who's doing civic engagement today? There's an organization called the Jewish Social Justice Roundtable. 57 organizations are doing the work today. There are 57 Jewish organizations doing this work. So if you want to get engaged, you can see them. Some of those organizations, HIAS, used to be called the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. And HIAS, they were called Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society because they met Jewish refugees, right? 1880 to 1920, millions of refugees were coming in. They even met my father's boat on August 1st, 1938. My father got here, thankfully, with his father, mother, and sister. But at some point, Jews stopped coming in after the influx of Soviet Jews. So HIAS had to make a decision. Do we fold as an organization, or do we become something else? So they're no longer the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. They're just HIAS. And they say that we used to help refugees because they were Jewish, but now we help refugees because we are Jewish. So if you want to organize on immigration issues, we work with HIAS and we organize nationally. Some other important organizations that would be interesting to you, the Institute of Southern Jewish Life, they do some social justice work. And then, pull some others. I skipped over some really important things about civil rights. But I think I have to move along. So if we have time, I would love to come back to the rabbinic voices and the Carolinas voices. Maybe I'm just gonna go back just one minute. I just love this period of history. Sorry, let's go back for a bit. Just one more thing about the civil rights. The North Carolina Association of Rabbis, they realized at some point they had a lot of rabbis in North Carolina, so let's organize and build power. 1950, they had their first meeting. By 1954, they were using their power, writing the president to advocate for Israel, writing the governor to support Brown versus Board of Education and the desegregation of schools in 1954. And the great writer of North Carolina history, the great historian of North Carolina history, which is Leonard Rogoff, he said, when it came to the state's rabbis using their voice during the civil rights movement, in contrast to the quiet voices of the Southern rabbinate, North Carolina rabbis spoke out. So they immediately organized as rabbis. They argued for separation of church and state, that by opposing teaching of the Bible and the offering of prayer in public schools. They wanted to strengthen Jewish identity. They worked to safeguard Israel's security through advocacy. They supported Zionism and building interfaith bridges of support. Some other rabbis who are really impressive in the South were, many, 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 and they were across the denominations, but in 1958, Rabbi William Silverman in Nashville, there was a bombing in Nashville of the JCC, and he got up and gave a passionate sermon, and he said, "I believe that any spiritual leader who does not speak forth and lead this congregation on moral issues is not worthy of being a rabbi of this congregation or any congregation. And I speak clearly and without equivocation that all may understand, together with the Central Conference of American Rabbis and the UAHC, I favor integration." And then Rabbi Milton Brackman in Birmingham. The 16th Street Church bombing was right before Rosh Hashanah. And he gets up on Rosh Hashanah, and the funerals were that morning. And he gets up and gives an extemporaneous sermon. And you can imagine what it would be like to be down the street from the bombing. And then he puts the names of the four girls who were killed in before Kaddish. And he said before Kaddish, he said, "Let us bow our heads in silence in memory of Denise McNair, Carol Robertson, Addie Mae Collins, and Cynthia Wesley, James Robinson, Virgil Ware, wantonly killed, insanely slain, brutally murdered, whose deaths we mourn, whose families we would comfort, and the shame of whose murders we would and we must have our city of Birmingham atone." So we are responsible for their deaths, and we need to atone. So rabbis spoke out in the South passionately, at great risk, at great risk to their congregations and at great risk to themselves. So moving to the present, who's doing this work today? We have the 57 organizations as part of the Jewish Social Justice Roundtable. We have leaders of American Jewish organizations. And this past week, I was in the archives at the American Jewish Archives, going through my dad's files from 1976 to 1978. He was the first Reform rabbi ever to be president of the President's Conference of Major Jewish Organizations. And there were telegrams going back and forth to him and Jimmy Carter, the UN, and to Begin. So I got through just one Carter file, one UN file, and some of the Begin material. But this is a handwritten note from Jimmy Carter to my father. Dear Rabbi Schindler, I appreciate your letter of this date. I can assure you that our position regarding the PLO is consistent with commitments previously made voluntarily to the Israeli government, with private and public statements made to present leaders in the Middle East, and with my own personal beliefs and hopes for permanent peace. Respectfully, Jimmy Carter. So there were, in my dad's era, there were letters every day going to the UN. If there was a negative vote in the UN, that vote, I think it's resolution 3379, I can check, that said that Zionism was racism. So what did they do? They wrote, as Jewish leaders of organizations, they wrote everyone who voted against it to say thank you for your support. They wrote to everyone who was absent that day or abstained and said, you're contributing to the evil of dark, the darkness of evil. And they wrote to everyone who supported it saying that this is dangerous. This is not what the UN stands for. So they were involved every day in advocacy. If we don't use our voice for our people, no one else will. It wasn't until 1991, till that UN resolution was revoked, but we need to be out there. Because if we're not out there, other people will be. And then we have congregations doing this work, grassroots organizations and individuals. So here in Charlotte, we have KKBE is one of 29 congregations working with Charleston Area Justice Ministry, working on all these issues. What we're doing is building power. So you might not agree with all these issues. Some of you are saying, you know what, this isn't us as a congregation, or really goes against some of our members' work. Let's stay out of this one. But yes, we really, really care about the lack of affordable housing or school-based arrests of little kids, you know. And so this is what we want to work on, and we're going to build power with other organizations. But in looking at this, I noticed there's another group also doing organizing. Okay, there's another group called Palmetto Family Nehemiah Network. Well, they are conservative churches. There are 250 conservative Christian congregations working on the other side, which is evident because we have some legislation in Missouri and Alabama that is taking away reproductive rights. So if we are not out there doing our work, then I assure you everyone else is out there doing their work. So we need to be at the table, because if we are not, we are complicit in what is happening in our community. So who is doing it? You saw who's doing it, 57 organizations, leaders of our movement, congregations, individuals, grassroots organizations. Why are Jews doing it? Title of my book says, civic engagement is good for synagogues, it's good for Jews, and it is good for America. So how do we know it's good for synagogues? Well, the Pew Research Study says, what's essential to being Jewish? Now, you all would answer these differently because you're here. You're supportive. You're part of the community. But the typical Jew on the street is not. So 7 in 10 Jews said remembering the Holocaust is essential to being Jewish, to not let this evil happen again. 7 in 10 said leading an ethical and moral life is critical to being Jewish. And almost 5.5 out of 10 said working for justice and equality is critical to being Jewish. Now, if you notice, having a good sense of humor, 4 out of 10, that's essential to being Jewish. And only 3 out of 10 said belonging to Jewish community. What that means is that for the majority of Jews, working for justice speaks to them. So if we can give them venues to express their Judaism with Jewish community, working for justice, that is good for our Jewish future, and that is good for our congregations. The congregation typically does 3 things. We avodah. Torah, Abu Dhabi, give me Luke Hasidim. We do Torah study and study of Torah. We teach it. We do worship, and we do acts of loving kindness. And my argument is we need a 4th pillar, which is civic engagement. Now, you all can say that's not my thing. I don't want to do it. Totally fine. But you know, we need a relevant Judaism to the rest of the community. We want to draw in people to say, we live a Judaism of relevance. So you don't need to do it, but I promise you that being out there in the community is where your others are. And so we call it a minion on the move. A minion, 10 people can create change. That's what Jewish tradition teaches, right? Abraham argued, Sodom and Gomorrah, argued with God, don't destroy that city. And Abraham said, if there are 50 righteous people, will you not destroy the city? And then Abraham bargained God down to 10. If there are 10 righteous people, God said he wouldn't destroy the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities. And so a minion has power. For years as a rabbi, on MLK weekend, I would not participate in the parade because it's on Shabbat, and we had Shabbat services, and I don't like to create competing issues. So Friday, an African-American preacher would come to Bethel with the choir. Sunday, I'd go to the church. And on Saturday, I'd make a non-announcement saying, if you happen to be going to the parade, there's a group gathering in the parking lot. I'm not endorsing it, but they're gathering at 9 a.m. if you want to join them. But it dawned on me, my younger colleagues were like, well, we can have an interfaith prayer service at the parade and then just get on the float. So now we are out there. We did an interfaith service at the Women's March, which was on Shabbat. So we had a service. Everyone I asked to speak spoke. A 70-year-old said, I've been marching for 50 years. My knees are aching. I'm tired. But I'm not going to abdicate my responsibility. Okay. So we need to do a minion on the move. We need to go where Jews are already gathered and be out there. That's what we need to do. So we have a group called Carolina Jews for Justice. When I go up to Raleigh, you know, they're there organizing. We're all organizing in our own way. Why do we need to be out there doing this work? To create a welcoming synagogue. Advocacy for the other, right? When I do a bus trip to Washington to legalize weddings in 2011 with 7 couples, that says to people, we're a really open synagogue. We're open to the other. And the reality is we are that other. We are as diverse as we're representing the people who are in our congregations. So advocating for that other communicates that the synagogue welcomes the Jewish family of today in its rich diversity. And lastly, how is it good for Jews? We're living our values. We're living the values we preach, right? If you look at farm to table, I went to a great restaurant in Charleston, farm to table. When we live our values, right, we're avoiding unnecessary destruction, we're paying wages on time, like when you think about the food you're eating, right, and you want it to be ethical and whole, all these aspects would have to go into it. Is it not hurting the environment? Are the people who grew the food being paid fairly? Is it protecting the earth? Are we bringing our morals to our menus? Are we walking the walk in our synagogues? And then we move to environmental advocacy. So it gives Jews a way to be authentic in their Judaism and whole in their Judaism. It's really important that we do this work to stand up against hate. Niemöller said, right? He was imprisoned in Sachsenhausen in Germany. And he said, first they came for the socialists and I didn't speak out because I was not a socialist. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. So why do we need to do this work? Let's just look at a minute and a half of Charlottesville and what they were saying. Sure. Let's start with Charlottesville. So just listen to the chants. You can go a little bit further. There are a couple more. Jews will not replace us. Chant number one.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay, don't worry. Okay, we can end. Okay, chant number one, Jews will not replace us. Anybody know what they meant by that? Oh. What did they mean? Okay, they chanted blood and soil, Jews will not replace us, white lives matter, and
replace us!
Don't worry, we're fine. We can go back to the PowerPoint. So what does that mean, blood and soil? It's a Nazi chant. They believed in Aryan blood, pure blood, and that's what they were saying in Charlottesville, pure white blood, Aryan blood, pure white Protestant Christian blood and soil. Well, why did the Germans need so much soil? Because their pure Aryan race needed more land, so they needed to invade all of Europe in order to have more land for the Aryans. They needed to invade the former Soviet Union in order to do that. Hitler wanted Europe to be Jew-free for 1,000 years. And so they were chanting the Nazi chants, blood and soil, and Jews will not replace us. So we're going to learn about And whose streets are streets? White lives matter. They're not wearing white sheets anymore. They're wearing polo shirts and khakis. And how many hate groups are here, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center in South Carolina? 17. We have 40 in North Carolina. So that's number one. So number two, I want you to hear Eric Ward. He's been researching these white nationalist groups for a long time. And he sort of explains how we got here, what these chants mean. So this is a very brief video. So, white nationalism has claimed responsibility for Mother Emanuel AME Zion. That ideology led to Charlottesville, to the shooting in Tree of Life Synagogue, to Christ Church, and to the shooting at Mentawai, California on the last day of Pesach, elsewhere in Shal Pesach, the last day of Pesach. So we need to be out there. We need to be out there calling out anti-Semitism, just like we call out racism and homophobia and Islamophobia, and we really need to build those partnerships, because if we are not, that ideology is spreading. And what is most fearful to me is that 1906 Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a fictitious pamphlet claiming that there's this Jewish conspiracy to run the world. We represent less than a quarter of the quarter of 1% of the global population. There's no way we are controlling the world. But there are people today, Muslims, who are reading this text, and Farrakhan spreads this text, and it's being published and published and published. We need to be out there, and we need to educate people on what religious anti-Semitism is, and political anti-Semitism, and the anti-Semitism of white supremacy, and the anti-Semitism of white nationalism. There are 17 hate groups right here in Carolina, in South Carolina. You can go on the Southern Poverty Law Center website and see them all. And there are some powerful responses to hate. You could read this latest housing resolution, the House resolution passed by the House of Representatives, condemning anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim discrimination. So predictions for the future. I don't know if we have time. Do you think we have a minute to go to the... So what do we need to do in the future? I could have you all, if we had an hour, half hour, 20 minutes, I'd have you talk to each other about what we need to do today. President Obama spoke to our biennial of the reform movement, and he, I think, states it best. Our future depends on our saying, Hineni. Our future depends on our building bridges and building alliances, on recognizing intersectionality, where our difference meets with others, and we can build power to create a safer future physically and psychologically for others. Eboo Patel says, faith can be a bubble of isolation, a barrier of division, a bomb of destruction, or a bridge of cooperation. By saying Hineni and engaging in this work, we can be that bridge builder who creates a better future. And in so doing, why does our future depend on it? We create a Judaism of meaning. Civic engagement speaks to the majority of American Jews. We combat anti-Semitism. We need to be out there educating people. And Israel's security, there are a lot of negative messages. There's a new book coming out in August on, I'm on the editorial team and wrote the opening chapter. And it talks about that there are, there's the Israeli left, they feel like the Israeli right fully supports the American right supports the Israeli right, and they're funding all the settlements and funding newspapers, free newspapers, and the American left has abandoned the Israeli left. There's a narrative that Israel can do no wrong, that they have the most moral army in the world, and there's a narrative that Israel can do only wrong. And we together need to build that third narrative. So there's an engagement. There's, I could come back and talk about that book if you want in the future. But it is critical, critical, critical. And we can make a difference, and our voice matters. When they ask me to help with this book, I'm like, what? Social justice in Israel, right? We don't vote. But actually, our voice matters, and we can and need to make a difference on that front. We need to build power to pursue justice, and we need to build political capital. I didn't have time to sort of talk about my story and why it matters to me, but Judith Schindler, we dedicated these stumbling stones in Berlin. Judith Schindler, I learned the person for whom I was named died at 32. She was deported to Riga on September 5th with her five kids from 10 to 2 and her husband, who was 34 years old, and they were marched out to a forest and they were shot. So our future, our safety depends on being there for others and building those alliances so that others are there for us as well. So this is what we learn, to build power with Tzlapachad's daughters, to pursue justice through Kedoshim, to speak truth to power with Nathan, to let the oppressed go free, to share bread with the hungry, Isaiah teaches, to match justice with ritual, Amos teaches, Moses Seishas teaches us to share our vision with our leaders, and the rabbis of the South taught us to act on our conscience. And David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, said, we Jews must never, never live in the past, but the past must always live on in us.
In the interest of time, I do invite you, if you need to visit the restroom, but we will be moving right on into our second speaker in just a minute or two. And so Rabbi Shimon will be around for a little bit, and I'll allow you, if you'd like to ask any specific questions, but we'll begin our second presentation in just a moment or two.
All right.